We're excited to announce that our very own podcasting platform, Zencastr, has become a new sponsor to the show. Check out the podcast discount link in our show notes and stay tuned for why we love using Zen for the podcast.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome to Heritage Voices, episode 38. I'm Jessica Yaquinto, and I'll be your host today. And today we are talking about Indigenous Australian archaeology. Before we begin, I'd like to honor and acknowledge that the lands I'm recording on today are part of the Nooch, or Ute peoples, treaty lands, the Dene Ta, and the ancestral Puebloan homeland. On today's show, we have Dr. Chris Wilson. Dr. Wilson is a senior lecturer in Indigenous Australian Studies and Archaeology at Flinders University. He's from the Lower Murray Lakes and Coorong in South Australia. Dr. Wilson received a Bachelor's of Archaeology from Flinders University, as well as a professional certificate in Indigenous research training and practice from the University of Melbourne. In 2017, Dr. Wilson was the first Indigenous Australian to be awarded a PhD in archaeology, which he received from Flinders University. In 2010, he served on the Expert and Community Reference Committee for the Department of Indigenous Affairs of the Federal Australian Government, Canberra, for the review of the International Repatriation Advisory Policy. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Okay. So I want to get this started with asking you how you got into archaeology and Indigenous studies.
Okay. So I guess I first heard about university when I was in high school, and I would have been around 13 years old, and I didn't know that it was an option back then. And it was actually my uncle who came to visit from Flinders University. He was working there at the time as a recruitment officer, and I mentioned that it's possible for Indigenous students to apply to university through a program. That kind of set, I guess, the wheels in motion for me in terms of thinking about university. I'd always been, you know, interested in culture, in history. I loved doing society environment projects and also astronomy and the dinosaurs. So I was always, you know, I had this curious mind, and I was, you know, always exploring lands around home and farmlands and our creeks and our rivers. So I guess I had a, you know, quite a interest at a young age for exploring, you know, country and exploring culture and history and heritage. So when I heard about university and what the options were, my uncle mentioned archaeology, and that popped, you know, that immediately was an interest for me. So I had chosen archaeology for my tertiary entrance rank, and also forensic science, because I was interested in human remains and burials. And it wasn't necessarily that I wanted to work around human remains. I just was fascinated by the skeleton and the body. And yeah, and I knew that there was a lot of burials within our country, a lot of Aboriginal burials. So I chose forensic science, but I guess I ended up going with archaeology for a few reasons. I mean, the first is that it, in terms of being able to travel, attracted me. The second was I could explore my own culture and heritage and identity. And the third one was that it was sounded like a really fun and exciting kind of career to have. So, yeah, I did my year 11 and 12, which we call SACE here in South Australia. It's the South Australian Certificate of Education. And I had just gotten the score I needed to get into archaeology. And I was the first in my family to go to university and to do a bachelor's degree. And as soon as I started, I just knew that archaeology was going to be the career that I was going to follow. I guess I was expecting to do classical archaeology as well and travel broadly Australia and the world. But that first year really kind of busted that myth for me, in terms of, you know, we could be exploring Egypt and Greece and, you know, be Indiana Jones. And I guess there was so much work in Australia, and I didn't realise how much more, you know, work there was to do here. And it was just amazing and mind-blowing for me. So I, made the decision quite early with a few other friends who were also Aboriginal. There's only three of us who were Aboriginal who started back in 2000. was our first year. Yeah, I just knew that I wanted to work with my mob, or my people from there on end, and there wasn't anybody in my community doing archaeology or that was trained in archaeology. So I was pretty much mentored by elders and community members and other academic staff throughout my degree. So I'm quite lucky to have the mentors around, both Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal. And, yeah, I've always been kind of a proud Aboriginal Australian. I like to acknowledge both my cultural heritage, and I think it's important. It's certainly important in this kind of field because it's so political that I kind of I'm up front with who I am and my cultural heritage, because I'm not just exploring my Aboriginal heritage. I'm also exploring my non-Aboriginal heritage, and there's quite interesting intersections which I've uncovered during my PhD research, which I'm starting to follow as one of my lines of research and interests. So, yeah.
Can you share about that? That sounds really interesting.
Yep. So I guess when I was doing my background research for my PhD, my literature review, and then my archival research, I came across some archives in some newspaper clippings in a journal that was written by Norman Tyndale. And Norman Tyndale is seen as one of the founding fathers for archaeology in Australia. He worked out of the South Australian Museum in the 20s and 30s and 40s, I think. And, yeah, he's acknowledged as our kind of our forefather for Australian archaeology. A lot of anthropology and history and archaeology excavations and surveys across the country. He took a lot of photographs as well of Aboriginal people and collected artefacts. So the South Australian Museum actually has one of the largest collections, archaeological collections in the world of Aboriginal artefacts. In that collection, there's human remains, there's a lot of wooden implements, because down in our community or down our region, there was quite a lot of wooden implements as part of the toolkit. A lot of photographs from that colonial period. So he documented quite a lot. He spoke to a lot of elders who have now passed. He had a lot of knowledge and were last speakers in our community, also last people who were initiated in our community. And so in those journals, and there's quite a lot of them, they're called the River Murray journals. And in one of them, I found a newspaper clipping of my uncle, whose name was Susty Wilson. His name was John, but his nickname was Susty, and that's how he was known. But he gave a report in that newspaper article at the age of 102, and he spoke about two things. He spoke about hunting kangaroos when he was younger in that day, which was in the 1930s when he was interviewed. There weren't as many younger people hunting kangaroo, and he would hunt, you know, 20 to 30 kangaroo back in his day, but in the 20s and 30s that was starting to die down. And the second thing was relating to whaling and sealing in that area, because we live along the coastal region, and we have quite a large island, Kangaroo Island. It's one of the largest islands offshore from the Australian mainland, besides Tasmania and a few others. He spoke about how the whaling industry started to impact our culture. And so he spoke about one of the accounts of whaling experiences he had with some of the whalers. And one day they got dragged out to sea when they were trying to harpoon a whale, and they got dragged kilometres out, and it took them a couple of days to swim back.
Wow.
For me, it kind of, I thought, well, there's quite a lot of knowledge around whaling and about the whales, and our people didn't traditionally, obviously, they didn't traditionally hunt whale. I mean, they're the biggest mammal on Earth, but they certainly had ceremonies around whales. So when the whales would get beached, particularly around the Encounter Bay, the Encounter Bay region, in Victor Harbour, there would be a big ceremony for that whale. And at that point in time, you know, people would actually, you know, use the whale for food, for ceremony, for trade. So all components of that whale. But I asked a few questions to one of the elders, Uncle George Trevorrow, who's now passed, about why my uncle was talking about the whale. And he said, oh, that's probably because the whale is one of your Nachis. And a Nachi in our language is totem. And for me, that was quite interesting. You know, I'm starting to reconnect with my culture through the animals and through whales and through whaling industry. So there's this interesting intersection between who I am and my identity and an archaeologist, but also, you know, my kind of heritage and my genealogies as well. Yeah, so the whole whaling thing story, I started to write into my PhD and what that meant for me, you know, as a Ngarrindjeri person and starting to rediscover that component of my history. And yeah, so it looked, I looked back in the genealogies, which were held by the South Australian Museum. And Tyndale, again, he wrote up these genealogies. And he also helped to draw up a map of Aboriginal Australia. So you probably might have seen there's a map that's done by David Horton. It's a colourful map which shows all the different nations and groups in Australia. Well, he actually based his work on Norman Tyndale's maps as well. So the genealogies of families, when I looked back at them, it took me back to one of our amicable ancestors. Her name was Fanny. And it isn't much recorded about Fanny from what I've tried to find, other than she was from Cape Jervis, that she was taken by a whaler called Wilson. And again, there's not much information about Wilson. But Wilson took Fanny as a wife and a domestic slave, I guess, or domestic wife, over to Kangaroo Island. Kangaroo Island had one of the major whaling stations for, you know, the southeast and that whole southern coastline before South Australia was set up as a colony. So that was back in the 1800s. Yeah, so it's from Wilson the whaler, who we think is French, from that kind of French whaling industry. But there's other reports, you know, that he's Scottish, that he's Finnish. And so I'm trying to find out his kind of connections. Yeah, but Wilson and Fanny, they had, children from where I'm descended from. And so that's kind of what I'm trying to explore now, is the whole history about whaling. And I'm working with Dr. Adam Patterson, who's a colleague of mine with the South Australian Maritime Museum, around that whole whaling story. So we're starting we want to start an archaeological project around targeting some of the whale sites and some of the whaling sites that they had along the coast and on KI. For future research. So that's one of the kinds of lines of research that I'm taking. And I've got some of my family involved in that who are interested in learning about their culture and heritage, some young people who are doing genealogies as well. So, yeah, that's that.
Yeah, that's really cool. So we're already almost at our first break. Before we go to a break, just a couple questions to get you thinking while we're on break, and then we'll come back and start with these. So, I'd love to hear more about the community or family involvement that you mentioned at the end there. And then also what you're looking at specifically archaeologically in terms of the whaling sites. So if you could talk a little bit more about this all ties together, that would be really interesting. So with that, we will be right back.
Chris Webster here for the Archaeology Podcast Network. We strive for high quality interviews and content so you can find information on any topic in archaeology from around the world. One way we do that is by recording interviews with our hosts and guests located in many parts of the world all at once. We do that through the use of Zencastr. That's Zencastr. Zencastr allows us to record high quality audio with no stress on the guest. Just send them a link to click on and that's it. Zencastr does the rest. They even do automatic transcriptions. Check out the link in the show notes for 30% off your first 3 months, or go to zencastr.com and use the code HEVO, HEVO. Looking to expand your knowledge of x-rays and imaging in the archaeology field? Then check out An Introduction to Paleoradiography, a short online course offering professional training for archaeologists and affiliated disciplines. Created by archaeologist, radiographer, and lecturer James Elliott, the content of this course is based upon his research and teaching experience in higher education. It is approved by the Chartered Institute for Archaeologists as 4 hours of training. That's in the UK, for those of you that don't know. So don't miss out on this exciting opportunity for professional and personal development. For more information on pricing and course structure, visit paleoimaging.com. That's P-A-L-E-O imaging.com. And look for the link in the show notes to this episode.
All right. And we are back. Mm-hmm. Okay. So we were just talking about all the different aspects of your PhD. So the personal family connections and your community and family involvement, and then the archaeology of the whaling sites itself. Mm-hmm. So you were telling us about the first of those three, and I'm really curious to hear more about the second two, so the family / community involvement, and what exactly you were looking at from an archaeological standpoint.
Yep. Okay, so just in terms of my family involvement in the community, so I'm Ngarrindjeri. Ngarrindjeri are a group from the Lower Murray Lakes in Coorong in South Australia. And there's different particular tribes or languages within the Ngarrindjeri nation. I guess it's more of recently we call ourselves all collectively as one nation. My particular family connects to the Coorong area, but also to the southeast, which is down where Kingston is, along the Coorong. So a lot of that Coorong area for me is my connection to country. My PhD is in the Lower Murray, and the Lower Murray area is quite important in that river system because it starts to meander through towards the southern coastline into Lake Alexandrina, Lake Albert, and then along the Coorong and then out to sea. So, I mean, that whole ecologically, that whole area is quite significant because there's fresh and salt water in that region. It's quite abundant in terms of food and resources. You have river red gums, one of the largest fish in Australia, the Murray cod, was the main fish for the river. There are also other types of fish species, smaller fish, lots of plants and vegetables. And so And then you move to the Coorong and you've got all the saltwater fish, and then you've got ducks and you've got swans and different birds and swan eggs, and swan egging quite important down that way. So I was using nets for trapping fish and birds and stopping the flight past the birds. The Coorong is one of the – it's on a register called Ramsar, and Ramsar is like an international – place of significance. So it's kind of equivalent to a World Heritage kind of area in some way. I mean, it's significant because of all the bird life that's there. So it's one of the areas that the birds migrate from the Northern Hemisphere to the Southern Hemisphere, and they do that on a yearly basis. And it has one of the most largest range of species of birds that come every year down to that area. So, and the Ngarrindjeri is seen as quite important people for looking after a lot of different types of species of animals, particularly birds and swans and ducks. We also got the pelican, which we call Nori. And I don't know if anyone's seen Storm Boy. Mr. Percival was a pelican. And Storm Boy was a movie which we grew up with, and that was filmed at the Coorong. So, yeah, I guess I'm just trying to paint a picture here of how significant the area is, because archaeologically we can see all of that. You know, when we do our excavations, when we're out there on country doing surveys, the whole country has, you know, one of the largest recorded areas for burial sites. And there was an archaeologist called Colin Pardo in the 80s who actually referred to these burials in the Lower Murray area as being like cemeteries. And that's important because the idea of Aboriginal people being nomads and nomadic and wandering around the landscape and not having any fixed places to burial was kind of busted. You know, that kind of myth was busted by Colin Pardo, who started to call them, you know, these burials as cemeteries, because there are markers in the landscape. And people did bury families and together in certain ways, and there were certain traditions and practices for it. And I guess that gives us an idea about your population size, and that if there are quite a lot of resources in the area, you know, archaeologists are starting to see quite a large number of this in the landscape through burials and through their analysis of human remains, then we know that there's actually quite a lot of people there living, and there's a lot of organisation in terms of the social organisation of space, the way that people interact, the way that people, their cultural practices. So there's, yeah, quite a lot of symbolic and, you know, social organisation that goes with, you know, large populations. So the Lower Murray is seen as having one of the largest populations of Aboriginal people at the point, at the point of contact in Australia. And this is one of the research questions that Australian archaeologists investigate. I guess the river system and the Coorong is littered with, well, not littered, but it's scattered with shellbins. So shellfish is one of the other primary resources that people ate. And there's mussel shells in the river. There's two different types of mussel shells. That was one of the sites that I excavated were midden sites. But within those middens, you get obviously bone from animals, so snakes, lizard, fish, the Murray cod ear bone, which we call the otolith, is actually quite significant for archaeologists because we can start to determine the species through the otolith. You know, species, even humans, have ear bones, and each ear bone has a signature in there. And they also grow rings throughout their life. So it's like a tree where it grows tree rings. And the fish also does that in its life. And because of the type of material that the body produces, or that fish produce, in terms of it's a carbonate type of material, the ear bone forms, it soaks up all the kind of elements in the environment. So we're able to do analysis, chemical analysis. We're able to do, you know, typological analysis. We can try to determine the minimum length of the fish by that, and we can do aging as well. So one of my colleagues, Dr. Morgan Despain, she did a fish otolith from the Lower Murray, from my excavations, but also from the Coorong, and another fish from there called the Coorong mullet, and a few other different types of species of fish. And she actually found that the Murray cod otolith, one of them from my excavations, and was at least 2.2 metres in length. And that's quite important for, you know, Australian archaeologists, but for environmentalists, for, I guess, for understanding, you know, the type of environment that was, you know, before, the type of environment and the ecology that we had before contact. So if we have bigger fish back then, the largest recorded fish since contact is 1.8 metres. So we're talking about, you know, 0.4 metres or 400, yeah, so 0.4 metres at least, then we know that there were quite large fish. And we have stories of the Pondi, which is the Murray cod, and Pondi travelled down and created the river in our region. You know, Pondi is described as being a giant fish. And so, you know, we can, yeah, the stories of our from our elders kind of correlate with some of the research that we found. And we don't compare it necessarily, but in terms of being able to, you know, find synergies and correlate some of that and try to find understanding between, you know, the Indigenous or our, you know, cultural worldviews and the archaeological research is something in which I try, you know, to explore my PhD, and it's something that a lot of people are starting to acknowledge in Australian archaeology, and, you know, that kind of deep, the idea of deep time is something that people started to look at and explore, the idea of Aboriginal people having agriculture or like agriculture is something that people are starting to explore. And also, you know, the kinds of navigation techniques that Aboriginal people had in terms of being able to sail up and down rivers, you know, sail along lakes to, you know, in the northern part of Australia, Australian archaeologists are still trying to find research around how human, you know, how our ancestors actually moved out of Africa, which is a theory, into Indonesia and then across the sea. So they're still trying to find the evidence for the sea craft and the watercraft, and then the technology that actually was able to bring populations over and be able to be sustainable across to the Australian continent. So there's quite big questions in Australian archaeology that are still being explored. Archaeologists in the maritime area explore that, and I've got some colleagues at Flinders University, Dr. Jonathan Benjamin, who is leading a project up in Western Australia, which is looking at submerged landscapes, looking for the sites and artifacts underwater, which they found some interesting results. Those results starting to come out, I think. But yeah, in the southern area, there's a lot of burials. We have rock art, or rock engravings mainly, and a lot of shelving sites, a lot of scarred trees, where people have carved out their canoes and their shields, and to make implements like the boomerang and other types of wooden implements. And the boomerang is quite an important implement for us as well. And David Yanipon, who is on the $50 note, is accredited to being one of the first Indigenous people to author in English. And he was also an inventor. So he created he had blueprints and had theories and ideas which related to physics and motion, perpetual motion. But he also used, the kinds of ideas around the boomerang and that technology for, ideas around propellers, helicopter propellers and flight, and also for electric shears, which helped establish, Australia's kind of, agricultural industry early on. So David Icon's on our $50 note, being, acknowledged for, his contribution to, Australian culture and just culture and history and science and engineering. And so he's authored a few books in English. There was a part of the university he named after him. It's called the David Yanipon School. I'm currently working with a media company called Butter Media and our National Indigenous Television in regards to a series which they've called The First Inventors. And this is still new in their development, but it's the second season for them. I've proposed that they do, kind of the episodes around the boomerang, because I think it's quite important wooden implement. People don't really give it enough credit in terms of, how important it was to make, the kind of skills that go into making wooden implements, and the kind of technology for actually using the boomerang and making that come back, or even to hunt animals, and the different styles and the different types is quite fascinating. And gives you, gives us all an understanding about technology and weaponry, how important that's been for our modern world. Because a lot of the weapons that we have in our modern times are kind of built on Indigenous people's knowledge and, their wooden implements. And I'm sure that's the same in North America in terms of knowledge that was there. And, so this is starting to come out in Australia, in terms of us being able to use science and history for education and for curriculum. So working with a few of our education departments and the university around indigenising curriculum, some around archaeology and heritage. People are really interested in the science and engineering space, and also agriculture and environmental science as well. So,
So there's like a million things that I want to ask you about all of that. Okay, so I'm going to save one of them for after the break, which is about the indigenising curriculum. So we'll save that one for a moment. Two quicker ones. Forgive my ignorance as an American, but the boomerang, it's always kind of it seems like it's used as like a joke a lot in like movies mm-hmm. and TV. It's like always. So I'd be curious to get your perspective on that, because obviously you're showing a great deal of respect for it, which sounds.
Mm. Yeah, well, there's different types of the two types of boomerangs that are more widely used, for Aboriginal people, are both for hunting. Obviously, there's a returning boomerang, which is also a hunting one, but there's also a larger style of boomerang. It doesn't return, but it's for larger mammals and animals, and you get those ones more in the central Australia and east coast of Australia. But, there's hundreds of different styles of the boomerang. So the key to the technology, the carving and the process of it, is something which I'm exploring with the South Australian Museum. But because of all the different types of boomerangs and sizes and lengths and
all of that kind of thing. But from what I understand, it's the actual face of the boomerang, which the wood's been carved, which helps, you know, which is, I guess, is the scientific aspect of it, which helps the returning boomerangs come back. So it's not just about the shape of it. It's also that kind of what's carved on the face of it as well. Yeah, but I may have to send a link to kind of explain it because I'm not too sure all the aspects of the boomerang and how to make it. But that's something which we're going to explore with some elders who are still doing some wood carving.
Yeah, I mean, that's fascinating. It's one of those things over here where it's, I don't know, you almost don't know whether or not that really exists because it seems so amazing. Mm. Although, like I said, the representation of it is a little, I don't know what the word would be exactly. It's not coming to mind, but not the most respectful, I guess. So the other part that I wanted to ask you about, which, I mean, I guess ties exactly into that too, is, you know, what you would want the world to know about Indigenous Australians. You talked a lot just now about some of the way that Australian archaeology is changing, you know, with the cemetery idea and, you know, the idea that people weren't just nomadic and all of these different aspects that you mentioned. Mm-hmm. So if there was something that you would like to set the record straight on, what would that be?
Oh, I think some of the dating techniques in Australian archaeology have enabled us to put the date back to 70,000 years, and that's some of my colleagues, Professor Chris Clarkson and his team, and his research, you know, kind of helped, you know, put that date back even further to 75,000 or something like that. And I mean, that's pretty amazing in terms of, you know, those dating techniques and the scientific techniques that go with it and the instruments that you use for them. But I guess there's limitations with those, and that's part of what we understand when we're doing our work in Australia, is that the instruments that we use for dating only take us back a certain time. So the radiocarbon dating only goes back, you know, to 100,000 years or so, and then you have to start using other techniques. So what we do understand, which isn't really on the record as such, because it's, you know, it's not something that you can really publish without having it tested properly, but we know that there's sites here, and we know that they're older than that, and we know that, you know, when Aboriginal people talk about and our elders talk about, we've been here for a long time, or we've been here for, you know, since the beginning of time, they're not just tips, that we just dismiss. And Australian archaeologists are really respectful with that in terms of understanding that there was actually quite a long, deep time here that people are conveying. And yeah, so the work with the submerged landscapes, for example, is because of the sea level changes over time have risen. And so a lot of sites, if they're going to be older, are actually going to be under the water. And so the maritime archaeologists are doing some amazing work, and I just want them acknowledged, mm-hmm. because it's quite a different landscape under the water. I haven't got my diving license, and I haven't done any of that work, and I haven't been on ships to do any of that kind of work. And it's amazing kind of work that they do. Quite rough terrain. It's, you know, different. I mean, we're using the same methods and techniques, but they have to, you know, they're very skilled in recording those sites underwater. And so some of this research is starting to come out now with their work in the last 5 years, where they've found the first site underwater up in WA, where they've found the first artifact up there. And I'm looking forward to reading their work for that to be shared, because, We knew that they were there, and we know that there's older sites around. But I guess that's the kind of space that people are going into. They're moving into, you know, there's submerged landscapes underwater. There's a lot of rock art sites which have been destroyed because of mining here in Australia, particularly up in the Burrup Pilbara region of Western Australia. And I haven't been up there myself, but from my colleagues, you know, they've been working up there for years, recording the sites that they can before they get destroyed. You know, there's lots of fascinating work up in the Northern Territory, in Queensland and the Torres Strait Islands, have amazing shell mounds. We've got, you know, the in the East Coast, and you know, we've got mountains up there. And that's the start of our kind of river system because of the mountains and the snow. And then when they melt, you know, that starts our river system. So, yeah, and then we've got some islands around too, you know, around the coast as well, which are quite significant. So, you know, in that desert area, you know, we've got quite a lot of desert in central Australia. Some of the arid region, you know, is it's uninhabitable. Like it's places where a lot of our early explorers actually died trying to cross those places. And yeah, it's just amazing the kind of knowledge that some of those Aboriginal communities who still live there have, like in terms of being able to have water holes and know where to go, and the knowledge that goes with plant biology and medicines, and that's still culture and history, culture that exists still. And you know, the Alice Springs and that central desert area, you know, still have traditional practices, and people still go up there from the cities to engage in ceremony or sorry business. Yeah, we've got a lot of history here, and you know, and a lot to look forward to as well, like in terms of the shared history and a new generation of people coming through, and hopefully a new generation of politicians. And yeah, I'm looking forward to kind of the kind of work that people are starting to bring out, and the new generation, young people who've got all these different skills across all different regions who are Aboriginal. I'm sure it's like that in North America too, where, yeah, they're just very, very savvy with technology and have very good ideas. And, yeah, just looking forward to future generations too.
All right. Okay. We are already at our second break point, but I want to touch on a lot of that right when we get back. So we'll be right back.
Hello, it's Jim Eagle. Please join us for the Bay Area American Indian Two-Spirit Society's 11th annual Two-Spirit Powwow in person or online this year at San Francisco Fort Mason Center on Saturday, February 12th, 2022. Gore dance at noon and grand entry begins at 1 p.m. There will be over 60 vendors selling all types of indigenous products and crafts. Powwow dancers from all over the U.S. will be competing in contests all day long. We'll also be having several delicious fry bread taco vendors. For more information, go to baits.org. That's BAAITS.org. COVID protocols will be in effect. See you there.
All right. And we are back. First of all, I mean, so we were talking before about your PhD, and I want to move on from your more recent work that you were starting to talk about. But I feel like I had heard, even before you were recommended to me for the podcast in 2017, I feel like I saw something about how you were the first Indigenous Australian to be awarded a PhD in archaeology. And I was like really surprised by that at the time, because, I mean, we don't have a ton of PhD archaeologists that are Indigenous here in the US, but we have some. And I was pretty surprised. I guess you always think like Australia and Canada are better with Indigenous issues than the US. So that one, that really surprised me, but that's pretty impressive.
I guess there's probably a couple of reasons for it. And I was surprised too, actually, to tell you the truth. So I didn't even know that until probably I stopped around the middle of my PhD. People started to ask whether there were any other Indigenous archaeologists in Australia that had PhDs. And I don't think so, because, you know, a lot of the colleagues and connections I've made have been from the US or New Zealand, and there's certainly people there. I guess there's probably a couple of reasons. One is, in Australia, the way that archaeology is practiced is a little bit different to the US and to some of our kind of neighbours and our colleagues. So it did start as anthropology here in the 50s and 60s. And then around the 60s, that changed. The Australian National University in Canberra was the first place that had archaeology as a discipline. And so they started to teach archaeology as a discipline, and they didn't have anthropology as such within it. And that could be one of the reasons why we don't have many. So we did have some in anthropology, but not in archaeology. And there weren't a lot of universities who were teaching it as well. And I guess in the 60s and 70s here, that's only, I guess, the beginning of the time when Aboriginal people actually started to have rights recognised, and people were allowed to start to engage in marriage in the education system, and to do other things like vote. I mean, different on different states. So some states, Aboriginal people could vote right from back when it was a colony, but in terms of like the federal politics and the federal landscape, the 60s are the kind of time when we had a referendum. So the 1967 referendum.
That's nuts.
To recognize, sorry?
Oh, I was just saying that's nuts. I had no idea it was that late. That's crazy.
Yeah, and so, I mean, and that was the kind of year of, you know, one of the years of others kind of global cultural, social, political movements happening, you know, with rock and, yeah, different, you know, different movements. So the Black Panther movement, I think, was one thing, or was one movement
that
Aboriginal people really picked up on in the US. Yeah, they even started their own kind of freedom rides here. And Charlie Perkins, you know, was the guy, was the Aboriginal leader, I guess, who started our freedom rides over here. Yeah, and started to be more vocal and activists and, you know, started to fight more for Aboriginal rights. So, yeah, it wasn't until the 60s that, yeah, I guess Aboriginal people were starting to engage in education. So at our university, the first graduate was in the 1970s. So, and a lot of those people went into the areas like education and health, obviously because those were areas that our community needed more people to be trained in, and nursing, midwifery, a lot of teachers at that time. So in terms of the science, areas in science, that has only been a more recent, I guess, choice for Aboriginal people. You know, as I said earlier in the podcast, I was the first in my family to go to university and do a bachelor's degree. I think only one of maybe two or three in my whole community who have a PhD. I'm only one of a handful from my high school to have a PhD as well. So you know, the area that I grew up in is south of Adelaide. It's a low socio and economic region. Not a lot of people have access to that kind of university education as well. Yeah. So that's big, some of the reasons why, but it's certainly given, I guess other people have been proud, and I'm proud and still kind of getting used to that. Certainly the university likes to use that as a platform to acknowledge that they've had their involvement in that. But certainly Professor Claire Smith was my mentor at Flinders University. She was one of my supervisors for my PhD. She's chair of the World Archaeological Congress. I think you may have interviewed her already.
No, but she's the one who recommended you.
So she's been a great mentor, and she's networked and connected me in, internationally, and she helped also with getting my first book contract with Routledge, and that's in the anthropology and archaeology section.
What's the title?
The title is Wurundjeri Ruwa and the Archaeology of the Lower Murray. So that's a preliminary title at the moment. It's a little bit long, but it's based on the PhD. It focuses more on the archaeology of the Lower Murray and the ideas of country and indigenous ways of doing things on country. So I guess the intersections between Wurundjeri and indigenous knowledge systems and the archaeological record and archaeological knowledge and my journey as well. So just bringing those two standpoints together.
So when is that going to come out?
It's August.
August? Okay.
I guess the other type of work I've been involved in has been with the National Indigenous Research and Knowledges Network. That was quite a large research initiative funded by the Australian Research Council. I think it was over $1 million funded for that project. I was one of the partners, but it was with a group of 50 Indigenous researchers from around the country, led by Aileen Morton Robinson, and started in 2014, and it's just about to finish, but it was a huge investment by the government to put funds and resources and training up more Indigenous researchers in masters and PhD level. So I was involved in some of that network in terms of doing some of the workshops, bringing people together. I also, another research project has been around repatriation of human remains. That's kind of the work I did before my PhD, was working with my community and helping with negotiations and with the delegation bringing back old people's remains from overseas, from their museum collections, from their anatomy collections, and also helping once they're back home about reburying them back on country and the process for that. So some of my work's been around the repatriation space. I continue to have involvement in that space. So I was recently talking with John Cardy from the South Australian Museum, and he heads up the, I guess, humanities part of the South Australian Museum. And he's really keen to get, well, he already has some more Aboriginal people getting involved in the training aspect in the museum. He's looking, they're doing repatriation programs in there that he wants to open up, I guess, the space for researchers to come in for education and research training. And also, redevelop the Aboriginal Cultures Gallery, because as I said, the South Australian Museum has one of the largest, I think the largest collection of Aboriginal artefacts in the world. And a lot of those artefacts were collected by Norman Tindall, but over time. So there's some discussion there about continuing work in repatriation, but for the state. Also,
I'm so confused. You mentioned that there was human remains in museum collections and anatomy collections. I don't think I've ever heard about this.
Yep. So overseas.
Yeah. Can you explain what?
Yeah, overseas and even here domestically, the anatomy museums, I guess the anatomy departments of universities where they did their medical training, used Aboriginal people's bodies, because it was under the states, like in South Australia, when Aboriginal people died, this is before the 1967 referendum, the Aboriginal people's bodies would become owned by the state. And what happened here was that a lot of the people were, used for medical research, for medical training. They were also sent overseas for the same purpose, mainly to the UK, but in other European and institutions. And a lot of those institutions were medical establishments, so they had anatomy museums attached to them, or they became anatomy museums. So, a lot of Aboriginal people's remains ended up in, not just the main museums, but in university departments, in university collections, in archaeological collections, different types of collecting institutions, and also in private collections too. So there are a lot of cases where researchers and medical practitioners actually, kept their own collections of human skulls, mainly Aboriginal skulls. But certainly, there's been, with our group, we had over 400 human remains returned from overseas by the University of Edinburgh. And as part of that collection, it wasn't just skeletal remains, it was actually organs and body parts as well. So, in terms of body parts still preserved in formaldehyde in jars. And I didn't actually look at inside any of the boxes when we were helping to do reburial ceremonies, but some of the anthropologists that we had were kind of relaying some of their own, disgust. I don't know if it's disgust. To their own surprise, what types of parts of the body and just the descriptions of it was kind of put me off a little bit in terms of wanting to pursue that any further with research. And I kind of stopped doing it for a while, and that's when I, spoke with elders and ended up doing my PhD focused on something which was more, a range of different skill sets, more focused on shell, on river, on different, But, certainly it's, we've still got quite a lot of old people sitting down at Camp Kurong in the keeping place, because there's been the government's withdrew funding, and it's not really funded for communities to do any work for reburial. And yeah, it takes a lot of organisation for that. So yeah, so that's the repatriation part. Colleagues as well around the idea of healing through archaeology and healing through heritage, these different aspects of people who've returned from war, people with disabilities, people with other types of the ways in which heritage and archaeology and reconnection can actually help with people's healing is something which colleagues are starting to collaborate with in humanities, archaeology, but also with our colleagues in psychiatry and psychology and in the health area as well. There's a conference coming up this year in October it's the ICOMOS, which is the International Community on Monuments of Science, I think. That's the name, ICOMOS. So the big GA General Assembly coming up in Australia this year. And I'm co-chairing the Indigenous Heritage theme for that with a colleague, Dr. Diane Menzies, who's from New Zealand. She's actually an architect? Yeah, she's an Indigenous architect. But looks at landscape. And so she's interested in heritage, but through architecture and landscape, the way in which people use the landscape for building settlements and so forth. And so that's going to be quite a large conference, quite a lot of work involved in that. And that'll be bringing together a whole, we've got a team from across the, from India, from Sweden, from all these different Indigenous people from around the world who we've got as part of our working team, as part of our theme. So going into the heritage space, working with museums as well. So as I mentioned, working with the South Australian Maritime Museum around the maritime on whaling stuff, the South Australian Museum around helping with the repatriation, but also the National Museum of Australia in Canberra. They have an exhibition coming up this year, and I've been working with them for a couple of years around displaying part of my work and the story of Pondi into their exhibition. So that's opening, I think, in the middle of the year, but I'll be sending one of the fish ear bones obelisks, one that was 2.2 metres, over to Canberra, just waiting for the community to approve it. They're going to exhibit some of that as part of the new exhibitions that are coming up. So, there's quite a lot of work to continue on down,
So are you're not working with Jenny Newell, are you? At the National Museum?
George May?
No? Okay.
Yeah. No.
Just kidding.
Okay.
So she was on Jenny Newell was on one of the earliest episodes of the podcast. I thought maybe she works at the Australian Museum, I want to say. Australian National Museum. Something.
Oh, there's Australian Museum as well in Sydney.
Okay. That's the one.
Yeah.
Okay. So we're getting real close to the end. So I'm trying to look and see if there's, like a final question that I should ask you. But I guess, is there anything else that you would like to add or talk about?
No, I've covered a fair bit there. I guess I didn't really, in terms of my career, wasn't expecting to end up or to be in a university or to be a lecturer. That wasn't my goal and it wasn't my plan at all. So when I started my degree, my kind of goal and was to travel, which I've done through my work. But I thought I'd be on excavations continuously, digging and just being directed by others. And so I guess towards the end of my degree, when I started to work around repatriation, do honours, which I guess is equivalent to like masters, but I had some colleagues, Indigenous colleagues at the university, who asked if I wanted to work in our Aboriginal unit, which was called Yungurindi at the time. It was the First Nations Centre for Higher Education Research. And, to work with young people, because I was only 21 at the time, and go into the schools and recruit more Aboriginal people into the university. And I've, really valued my experience, as an an academic advisor, they called us, but we were academics, but also recruitment officers. So we were still doing research and teaching Aboriginal studies. So I'm currently teaching in archaeology and Aboriginal studies, Indigenous studies at Flinders. I give guest lectures at other universities here in the state and also interstate, across the different degree programs. So not just in humanities, but, sometimes in science or health. And, I've only just, been in the university sector for now 15 years and starting to see people graduate with their PhDs, and I've, seen some of the students who came in, way back 10 years ago, who've now finished their medical degrees and are now training doctors. Recently had dinner with one of them, and, she thanked me for coming out to a school and talking, because that kind of, I guess, set her wheels in motion. And I've gotten a lot of reward out of that, I'm grateful to have had these experiences in universities and help, other young Aboriginal people come in and do well with their life. And, it's really inspiring to see. So, I'm kind of – didn't expect to be – end up as an academic, but, I like what I do, and I'm just going to continue working with university and working with my community and just sharing the knowledge and the education of what I do.
Well, we can't wait to hear more about what you get to in the future and more about your work and everything. I'll have to talk more sometime.
No worries.
Yeah. All right. Well, I mean, as always, there's a million other things I could have asked you about.
Sure. Yep.
But thank you so much for
coming on and
talking to us today. All right. Well, thanks, and talk to you later.
Thanks for listening to the Heritage Voices podcast. You can find show notes at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/heritagevoices. Please subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, or the Google Music Store. Also, if you like the show, please share with your friends or write us a review. If you have any questions, comments, or show suggestions, please reach out to me at jessica@livingheritageanthropology.org, or you can find me on Facebook through Living Heritage Anthropology or on Twitter @LivingHeritageA. As always, thank you to Lyle Blanqua and Jason Nez for their collaboration on our incredible logo.
This show is produced by the Archaeology Podcast Network, Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in Reno, Nevada at the Reno Collective.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to archpodnet.com/members for more info.